Stop that ship! Blast them!
Hello, my friends, and welcome to our latest episode of Armor Party, episode 11. I can't even believe that. Thank you for putting up with our wonky schedule over the last 2 weeks. I'm getting caught up on some great conversations and making sure I'm doing my diligence of keeping the quality of this show to where you all expect. I hope you've all been enjoying the latest Star Wars project called Visions. We're breaking it down over on the Think the Maker podcast this week, so definitely tune in to hear some behind-the-scenes tidbits we found, and holy cow, that cast of voice actors, they got to do the voices, incredible work. Excellent work to Lucasfilm and the animation studios for knocking that out of the park. But let's get back to the armor. I'm excited for this next conversation. I try to do my best to highlight and feature people who have been awesome and amazing within these communities that are kind of the go-to people for all of the questions that newcomers make. So after the conversation, please do tag him and let him know it was cool to hear him on the show. So fire up that Razor Crest, push the lever on that hyperdrive, and let's go. My next guest has been on my list of hopeful interviews since I learned about his work in 2019. As a professional fabricator, he has both the talent and the experience to earn the label as one of the best modern Star Wars prop makers in this galaxy. But it's not just his perfectly weathered Beskar paint jobs that sets him apart in this community. It's his willingness to share tips, break down steps, and encourage us all to keep pushing forward. From the windy city of Chicago, Illinois, we are joined by Tim Harrison of HDC Fabrication. Tim, welcome to the Armor Party.
Thank you so much for having us. Or me. I guess I'm a singular at the moment.
That tells me that you know how much work you actually do and how much it takes to run a shop, because you feel like you are both the judge, jury, and executioner, I'm sure. How are you, man?
Good, man. It's Monday, getting a good start off to the week, and glad we were finally able to make this work.
Yeah, I know that I've been trying to link up with you, and I've been such a fan of your work. I feel like in the Din Djarin build group, and there's a couple in there too. And I had talked to Luke Daly, and I remember that he had mentioned you and being one of the people who really kind of emerged as someone who's not only able to execute the skill of the modern Star Wars costumes, which is infinitely, in my opinion, more complicated than the beautiful wonkiness of the original trilogy suits. Yeah. But I have just followed your work for a long time and really appreciated how kind you are and how patient you are with people who you can tell are excited about making these costumes, and also going, hey, I'm willing to talk with you as long as it takes, but it's not like, you know, we're spraying a, you know, can of Rust-Oleum on something. Like, this is like a full send application here. So I just want to say thanks for helping me with my build, as I'm at the date of this podcast, I'm almost done.
The way I look at it, it's, I guess, like, back in the day, there was such a gatekeeping, knowledge hoarding aspect to just the cosplay and costuming community in general. And I feel like as individual makers, as we learn and grow and make mistakes and things like that, it's putting that information out there not only helps fellow makers and beginners, but then they can take those ideas and roll with it and do their own thing with it and further innovations and progress throughout the community.
I have very fond memories of my college years going to visit friends in Chicago. And the summer that I spent a lot of time there, they were filming The Dark Knight. And my friend had actually seen what he described as this crazy hobo looking guy riding a skateboard, which turned out to be Heath Ledger just winding down from an all night shoot, riding his longboard through the city of Chicago.
Wow.
And just seeing that we were, you know, out at night going to bars and across the street, you know, things were closed off because Christian Bale was there and they were filming Public Enemies and Depp was there. And that city has such a rich history of filmmaking and performances. I think most of the performances and plays that I've seen in my life have actually been in Chicago. So being from there, you know, how did you get started in with the professional fabrication prop building community, and what was your story getting into that?
So I think just like a lot of us, to make the transition into doing this kind of work professionally, it started out as a hobby. It's my love for Halloween and just making things and tinkering and just messing around. And I kind of got a late start as far as it comes to like cosplay and costuming, because I didn't realize that it was a thing at conventions until I was probably 25 or 26. Just because I was really the only person in my family that was kind of interested in that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So I didn't have any additional exposure to it. And I just decided to make some steampunk stuff for Halloween one year. And through studying on aesthetic and just build stuff through that, I found this whole line of steampunk conventions and then started doing those, and then found out about like the craftsmanship contests and all that jazz, and then C2E2 and so on. And it just blossomed and exploded through there. As far as like the business side of things, I had an IT business for ages. I originally went to school for electrical and computer engineering, and then just jutted off to a few other things. But being a big Star Wars nerd, I wanted to make robots because of Astromechs and like do animatronic work and things like that. So that was my original intention. And then throughout the hobby side of things, as I did more work and did more contests and things like that, I started getting more into back into the electronic side of things. And 2012-ish, 2013 was kind of like right around when the microcontroller and like NeoPixel stuff started picking up.
Yeah.
So as that kind of equipment became more readily available and easily accessible, I was integrating that more into my prop work versus just like your basic 5mm LEDs and like classic electronic setups and whatnot. And I had a moment when I was making something for my girlfriend, and it just kind of all clicked. Oddly enough, it was a steampunk Princess Leia, of all things.
Okay.
Making a weird glowy headset. And then I was like, this is pretty much what I wanted to do. And I didn't realize it until that moment, and things kind of came full circle. And at that point, I started my IT business when I was about 20. So I got a young start, made a lot of mistakes, but because I started a business and made all the mistakes when I was young, I feel that gave me a big heads up when I decided to change my career path and start a new business. So I think 2017 is when I first like started to slowly do commission work. Then I had that epiphany moment and then filed the new paperwork in February of 2018, and just continued to bust things out and work my tail off to get things going. And between working way too much and some lucky networking and just some happenstance, that's pretty much what's gotten me to where I am today. Just very fortunate, I feel.
Sure. And what are some of the projects that HDC has worked on? Is it local Chicago, or have you worked on any regional or national projects?
Done some bigger projects. A lot of the building that my shop is in is primarily industry makers, which is great, but it's a lot of commercial work and a little bit of film TV stuff. But Chicago's not really known for sci-fi and fantasy type shows. It's like Chicago Med, Chicago PD, so it's all blood and gore and like silicone special effects work. So that's the work they bring, and that's the work that most of the fabricators in the city put out, aside like weird commercial things.
Right.
Fortunately, I've just through networking and being in the building, and some industry friends actually invited me to be in the building. So I got to know some of the other folk there that brought me into commercial things, because I'm one of the few people in the area that can do the kind of work that we do. So long story short, like one of the most recent things that I can talk about is, Miller Lite and New Balance did this weird joint marketing thing for Father's Day. And they developed a beer koozie in the style of this particular model of New Balance running shoe.
Oh man, I saw that. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I helped make that.
Really?
Yeah. So we did all the prototyping work and the master printing and mold making and casting for all of the sole, the bottom sole part, and then all the leather work was actually done by a tailor upstairs. So that was a fun recent thing that I can talk about.
Yeah. So
it's weird stuff.
For people who are wondering what Tim is talking about, the classic dad shoe, you know, your New Balance white shoe is, there is a koozie that I thought was hilarious because, you know, of course you have young dads like me who have kids that are under 10 that have kind of leaned into this idea of being, you know, you got to go outside and take care of your lawn at 7 a.m. and run to Home Depot. And the white New Balance is like, for some reason, the American dad's just, you know, iconic look. And so I saw that. I thought that was hilarious. Tim, if you have one, I might need one. So now you know that I'm lobbying for it right here on the podcast. I want to also know, too, specifically because I know you from the Star Wars community, what is your Star Wars story in particular?
I must have been probably 3 or 4, and I don't know if it was a family gathering or what, but I think my cousin put something on the TV, and I remember these weird-looking robots and, like, space fights and stuff, and that was my first exposure to Star Wars, and it's like some of my earliest memories. And then like, I wish I still had it, but like my grandma had, between that and this, it was an original like 78 Kenner C-3PO. It was just awesome and neat and gold and shiny. I just fell in love with the story and the universe and the look and everything, to the point like where I mentioned earlier, I wanted to make astromechs. That's what I wanted to do for a living. And it just, it opened up so many conversations with friends, good things and bad things. Like I remember watching the special edition in, I believe it was junior or senior college with some of my best friends, before we knew that Hayden Christensen had replaced old Anakin in the Return of the Jedi scene.
Right.
And we lost it. We flipped. Like, why does this happen? but like just stupid, weird stories like that throughout my childhood, and watching the prequels when they came out finally, I think it was in middle school or high school. It was middle school. Getting all those stupid Pepsi cans and then not drinking them and then finding them again 20 years later. It's so many aspects of my life with social interaction and just enjoyment and leisure activities.
Yeah.
Have revolved around that universe. It's crazy kind of actually thinking about it and looking back, and it's been such a huge impact on my life from so many different aspects. It is just, I feel like I'm rambling at this point, but
that's great. Because for me, you're probably the same way, you know, between my side business Hondo Supply and now this, you know, there's just it's crazy how Star Wars, how much it plays a role in my life. And for you, it's like you go on Facebook every day and see that someone in the costuming groups has added something to the discussion, or I've got a question, or hey, is anyone hurt? You know, and it's like it's this club that you never really leave. It's a constant conversation of excitement, and we've learned more, we have more knowledge, we have insider info, and this, and I think there aren't many other things in my life, I would say, that have made such a lasting impact as Star Wars. So it's awesome to hear your story. And I always love asking that question to guests that are on Armor Party, because I find that everyone's unique story is, of course, their own, but also how things like the Pepsi can, man. And you were chasing the gold Yoda Pepsi.
Oh yeah.
Everyone like, Mom, we got to buy more Pepsi. We got to get the Yoda thing. Yeah. And it's hilarious now, because you see people occasionally trying to sell the full set of Pepsi or Mountain Dew, you know, and they're like, oh, I have a full set of Pepsi. And you're like, in some weird way, I want that, but also I don't. I want nothing with that. So it's a Star Wars thing for sure, that you can never just have one thing Star Wars. You have to collect the entire series. So Tim, what I want to ask you as well is, when did you, as a professional prop maker and someone who clearly is a massive Star Wars fan, when did you kind of start to embrace your ability as a costumer and as a fabricator into saying, I understand how these costumes are made, I understand how these things are broken down, that you really started to realize, hey, these are modern costumes that are a lot more intricate, and, you know, I've got the ability to understand how these things work? Was it The Mandalorian? Was it the new, you know, was it the sequel trilogy? What was it for you that made you start to say, hey, I think I'm going to start making some of these costumes? Or at least just recognizing that you understand how they work.
So I actually, in the Star Wars community at least, got started doing leather work. So I made a lot of the Han Solo rigs ages ago. It was like me and Adam Carolyn.
I've got one of his templates for the Bespin fatigue.
Oh, yeah.
Actually, yeah. He goes by Carolean Dry Goods, right? Is that his new?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. Perfect.
So it was that stuff. I've been playing around with leather work, with the steampunk stuff, and then I've been wanting to do a Han Solo costume for years. Started looking at the details to make the belt. I knew I didn't want an aluminum hardware set, so I designed a steel hardware set for the belt. Even though I think the original one's still aluminum, I believe, I just wanted something a little hardier. And then one of my buddies was big into Luke and asked if I could make him an Empire Strikes Back Luke set up for him. So between those two, I kind of started doing a lot more Star Wars leather work and like hardware designs and whatnot. I was doing that for a bit, and then like some resin cast DL-44s and things like that. But it really wasn't until Mando, I guess, that I got super excited about Star Wars again. I remember the announcement for Mando and just seeing some of the shots and everything, and we've never seen anything on screen from the Outer Rim and like grungy Mandalorian bounty hunter type stuff.
Right.
And season one aired, and from him walking through the door in that cantina, just being a badass.
Right.
And then grappling, hooking the guy through the door and guillotining him in half. But like, like this is the grungy new Star Wars tale that is still very clearly and definitively in the Star Wars universe. And it just completely reignited my flame for making Star Wars things again.
Sure.
And then I took the deep dive into the armor. And that's how I met some of the other guys in the group, like Luke and Terry and Jackson, and there's like a core group of us that have been researching this stuff since the beginning, and
yeah,
we still talk every day. But I haven't had a dedication or involvement to a singular particular costume before like this. And like,
sure,
we've been deep diving for almost 3 years now, I think, on this junk, and it's crazy to look back and think how much time has passed, but also awesome that, again, like kind of like how people were still finding like new FET details 20 years after like Jedi and whatnot came out.
Right.
It's just meeting those guys, and then skill development, and just other industry contacts like Sam at Imperial Surface and like WeChat a lot. And it's just, it's really cool finding like a good group and a great community of very passionate makers and just costumers and people who are all excited about Star Wars again.
Right. And were you one of the groups that developed the CRL as well?
Yes.
Awesome. If you're listening to this and you haven't gone back into the Armor Party deep dives, we talked with, Tim is talking about Luke Daly, who is over in the UK, and he was, he's one of the admins of the group on Facebook, but also one of the, you know, one of the four or five people that developed the CRL for the 501st version of both the version one and version two of season one armor for Din Djarin's Mandalorian. And I think it's really great because between people like you and Luke, you know, Luke has a fabricating background as far as being, you know, a modeler, and that's literally his day job. And so he's become that person who understands how pieces break down, and he is completely neurotic, which I love, because he just has his affinity for detail and understanding, the ability to get measurements and prototype and understand that, yeah, we are going to make premier versions of these accessories. And I have a kit myself on my Mando, and when I have other people that come over and look at the stuff, and they see the shell cartridges and they see the, you know, the buckles. And when they see all this stuff, they're like, wait a minute, man, this is real metal. And I'm like, it is. And thankfully we have people in the community that have been able to replicate those to pay homage to all of the decisions that Legacy FX has made with the original suit. So it's a really cool to see and have all of you. I think I've talked to every single one of you individually. The previous episode has Terry Chu on it, and Terry's awesome because he's an old school fabricator, an old school and a hobbyist kind of at that too, which is great because his day job wasn't in that, not unlike Luke's, but his ability to say, I'm passionate enough about making props and also making tutorials. It's really cool that I think the four or five of you that are involved in this group that are leading the way for development and research on this costume also are some of the most kind and helpful people that I've met. So huge props to Luke and Terry and yourself and everyone who's involved with doing it, because this build has been such a treat. It's been hard as hell. Yeah. But it's been awesome getting to know all of you guys. So what I would love to know too is, can you share with us your process of, you've been around steampunk, you have an understanding, and Star Wars in many ways almost kind of represents, I've talked about this a few times, this lo-fi universe of where technology is certainly a part of the storylines. It's where we recognize where they use technology, but at the same time, everything's dirty and grungy, and you know, engines look like they've needed to be restored and they've been brought back. And you go, ooh, what's that? There's no handles in freaking Star Wars. Everything's on a, you know, blink, blink, blink. You know, there's a comm link or something that opens the doors. So Tim, your background, of course, with, like I said, a steampunk affinity and understanding how that goes, what do you define as being a Star Wars vibe? You know, what is for you? And you said that, you know, some of the newer movies felt a little too clean or they didn't feel Star Wars, but Mandalorian, I was in that panel at Celebration when Jon Favreau introduced it. And he is like, hey man, yeah, this is going to be like a space Western. And I'm like, what the hell does that mean? And I saw it and I was like, whoa, this is basically Star Wars' version of, you know, Dirty Harry, but set in the good and the bad and the ugly. I'm like, I'm in. What is it for you? What is a Star Wars vibe for you that you gravitate towards?
Overall, two very distinct looks in the universe. You've got the Empire, or First Order, or the bad guys, essentially, who have that very clean, regimented, colder tone look throughout their ships, their uniforms, everything. It's a very cold color palette. And then the wonderful gray area and like the good guys and the rebels, it's more of that grungy, worn, warm tones, kind of hodgepodge assembled look of uniforms or armor or things like that. And there's such a charm to that chaotic cohesion, I guess you could call it. And it's It's very distinct, and again, kind of like the old Westerns, it's a dusty, dirty, grimy city, and you've got these kind of nicer clothes, but they're covered in like mud splatters and dust just from walking out in the desert, and it's such an integral part to the Star Wars universe. I feel like we're introduced to the universe with Luke on Tatooine, and he's in this windblown double sun desert and these kind of ratty linen bleached denim clothing and just dirt and grime. And the first movie, especially, it's a consistent vibe. And it really set the tone for the entire universe with like the cantina and just everything. And one of the things, going back to like 7, 8, and 9, I almost feel they looked a little too produced almost. Sure. They kind of lacked that little grungy feeling a little bit, where I feel the biggest difference between that and Rogue One, I think, is Rogue One still very much captured that A New Hope kind of grunginess feeling.
Sure.
And that's that grimy kind of hodgepodgey worn warm tone is like the definitive Star Wars look for me, with like some of those kind of World War II old military style equipment and vibes and weird buckles and things like that. It's layers and warm tones and dirt and grime and just cool.
Of course, yeah. Cool. Yeah, and the reason I ask is because I really love your approach to weathering and taking a costume. There's so many people I feel that get it confused with, you know, Din's Beskar armor is, you know, it's shiny. It's almost like you put a light on it, you can see it from space. It's like, no, he's, you know, this dude is a professional bounty hunter. And at this point where we know his story, he is being hunted by half of the universe. And right. So, you know, to have those, when I look at your work up close, I'm like, oh man, this is just chef's kiss, because the armor is still absolutely represented by that, you know, Beskar steel, but it just has that worn look that you would expect. And I love it. And that's why I just had to ask you, like, what is Star Wars? You know, what is the aesthetic for you? Something that you had talked about earlier was, because you've been in the prop making game for a long time, and if people are curious, please head over to Tim's Instagram, because whenever you post videos, it's like I'm watching a mad scientist in his laboratory, man. You've got resin printers and 3D printers, and then you've got the paint booth and all this stuff in this awesome old Chicago space. So would you say in the accessibility, oh my gosh, of, as someone who's recently got into 3D printing, and now I feel like, oh my gosh, resin printing is kind of already here. You've seen this difference of 3D printers being these kind of hobbyist novelty, well, this is fun, it can make this crappy plastic little thing, to now being a complete part of your workflow. So what have you really seen over the past couple of years as far as hobbyists now being able to purchase affordable machines that can do quite a lot of work? And once you get them fine-tuned, which I think is the gripe for most people, but what have you seen over the past probably decade as far as those kinds of technologies?
Been a lot of refinement, especially when looking at like filament printers, a lot of refinement in just their functionality and bringing that price point down. I was one of those, so I've got a traditional sculpting background, so when printers started becoming more available, I was in this weird spot of enjoying the mechanics and like the robotic nature of it, but
sure.
just due to my ignorance, I was like, oh, 3D printing is cheating, blah blah blah, and that it was strictly from a viewpoint of pure ignorance. And it's such a, when I first got introduced and got my hands on, it's no different than using a sewing machine or like a rotary tool versus doing everything by hand. It's they're wonderful tools that once you learn their process and get things down, it's a great accessory to the arsenal. And especially the last couple years, like all the work that Creality has been doing refining their original CR10 line, and then all the clones coming out making their own refinements, and then lowering costs and just making things more efficient, and you get more bang for your buck. It's taken a lot of that initial configuration out of the process. There's still, sure, again, even upwards of $1,500, these are still considered hobby grade printers. So there's still, right, a lot of calibration and things like that, learning the machines, learning their quirks. I've got a couple original CR10s that I've upgraded, and just because everything is calibrated one way and then I get this new printer in, all of a sudden it's got some just additional quirks, just because maybe something is out of alignment slightly differently from shipping or whatnot, and you need, yeah, to work through that. And it can either be easier or more difficult to get the hardware fully optimized for to produce the product that you want to.
Sure, sure.
But as like they're getting the Pro line out, and they've got their new CR6 and the 30 and the new CR7, it's becoming a more accessible from the standpoint, like if you're not very mechanically or technically inclined, which in the past and still relatively recently, you needed to be very mechanically inclined in order to operate these machines, which I think was a lot of gripe with people, because people getting into the scene, they think it's kind of just like a push and go kind of thing. And there's sometimes a good month of like calibration work to get these things rolling the way you need to, especially if you're new to it and you don't know what's going on with the machine. And the last probably year and a half, 2 years especially, it's made that more accessible. It's a lot easier to, like, especially like the Ender 3 is like kind of one of like the go-to intro machines that I always recommend to people. And they've got like their version 2, and I think like a Pro V2 out now as well. And there's so many just subtle little changes that they've made to better optimize the user experience to introduce new folk into this hobby and this new tool. And it's made a huge impact where you don't need to fight and get frustrated trying to get these things to work properly. And then like on the resin side of the world, Elgu and Anycubic, they kind of broke the mold like with the original Mars and whatnot. And that technology is just exploding so fast. And Frozen with the new Mega 8K, Diopoly with the XXL and their standard phenoms, like the form factor for that is just exploding beyond what we originally thought it was going to be. Like the XXL, I'm fortunate that we have one in the shop. It's build volumes almost double two CR10s on a resin printer.
Wow.
A somewhat commercially or hobby-ish, it's an expensive machine, but it's, I guess, if as a hobbyist, it's still kind of attainable.
Sure.
What's the price on that, Tim? What were you paying for that?
About $9,500.
Okay, so $9,500, and that's a fully closed. Well, let's do this. I'm someone who, you know, I don't have a lot of time. I'm kind of like a set it and forget it. I like to print stuff, mm-hmm. and you know, it's interesting that you bring up a lot of people wanting to, you know, if I can credit Apple for anything, it's that they've turned us into people who have been like, I just want to take it out of the box, plug it in, and then it just starts working. And I think that oftentimes we forget how fast technology has come for mm-hmm. us to really not need to calibrate anything. And a lot of these printers come from, you know, they come from overseas, and then you have, I want to say suppliers like tiny machines that will actually go and they'll test and they'll make sure that the machines are actually working, because oftentimes you're ordering something off you know, Amazon from Creality. Okay, cool. It shows up right from the factory, and you have, exactly like you said, you have no idea if it's been tested, if it works. And so sometimes you could just straight up have a bad machine right out of the box.
Right.
It doesn't always happen, but I've heard enough horror stories of people going, man, I take the thing out of the box and I've got to replace this thing or this thing or this thing. And resin printing, the benefits, at least from my understanding, you can probably explain it better, but resin printing is just a different form of getting something to adhere to the bed. It's actually using UV light to cure the resin. And the benefit for people is that the prints are oftentimes stronger, they're smoother, they take less prep work. Like the amount of sanding most people don't realize you have to do for 3D prints is insane. And so what am I missing between the big difference between those two and your experience of saying, you know, let's say if I've got $1,000 and I'm looking into getting into this hobby with intentions of costuming, I mean, what's your pick of recommending machines? Are you still in 3D printing, or you're like, get into resin printing at this point?
I guess it depends. There's, again, just like anything, there's pros and cons to both.
Sure.
From a mechanical standpoint on the printer itself, resin printers are so freaking simple. It's pretty much all you need to do is follow the instructions on leveling the build plate, and it's ready to go. There's no XYZ motion that you need to worry about. It's just up and down, and then the masked LCD takes care of everything on your X and Y. So it's like mechanically, it's a very, very simple machine. The trickiness, and I guess the pros and cons, come into play with material costs between the two. The level of surface preparation, like you mentioned, between the two. And the setting up the file itself is a very, very different beast on resin printers compared to fused filament fabrication. And it's there's a little bit more of a learning curve there.
Sure.
Because you need to, especially as the printers get larger, you need to take into account the suction forces with the extra volume of material in the resin vat. So the larger the printer, the more volume of fluid is in there, and it creates more suction force. So you need better support options, better orientation, and things like that, which is, it can be a little tricky to get the hang of at first. But once it clicks really well, and then you're pretty much set. As far as a hobbyist goes, The basic resins compared to PLA, PLA plus, PETG, they're rather brittle. You're looking at your $20 to $35 a bottle resins, like your basic EL goo, like Serratech Fast and things like that.
Okay.
Even though they are ABS like, they're still pretty, pretty brittle. Like borderline, I would say good for miniature work, but you still need to be careful with them. As far as like wearables and, like live use props and things, like you start getting into a trouble because any kind of drop or anything, and there's going to be a catastrophic failure because it is so brittle. So then you start getting into the higher price point resins to ensure that durability for like wearable armor, wearable props and things like that. And you're looking at $56 or $50 to $60 a bottle, upwards of $80 a bottle, depending upon what you're looking for, compared to filament printers where you are looking at $15 to $25 a spool.
Right.
And then you're spending $20 to print a helmet, versus $90 to print a helmet on a resin printer.
Right.
So that trade-off as a hobbyist could turn people away from resin printing, and especially on the side of wearables and not having to reinforce resin prints and things like that, because it's a trade-off in material cost versus your effort
into
making it a usable prop. So we, with our filament printers, we use a lot of PETG. We only use PETG, which is not only great for heat durability, but it also sands a hell of a lot easier. So I've gotten that processed pretty refined, but even compared to a full resin print, we can fully prep a resin print, which there's still a decent amount of sanding to it, but it's, we're looking at like a quarter amount of the time, maybe.
Right.
So from a business perspective, be it myself or one of my team members, the cost of materials outweighs the cost of labor that goes into the preparation for that particular item.
Sure.
So it's a very, very viable cost for us, but I understand as a hobbyist, that's not necessarily the case. And I've gotten into big arguments about that in a couple of the resin printer groups before, because people, especially as hobbyists and like some of the younger crew, they don't consider the cost of time, or even as hobbyist commissioners and things like that, just the concept of putting a value to your time can be very foreign. Often where people undervalue themselves, they undervalue their skill sets, they undervalue just their time in general. So a lot of that comes into play as well. So at least for us, there's a huge benefit to resin printing something to cut down the actual man hours of labor that goes into that finished thing. And then especially like side by side, depending upon what it is, especially on the XXL, I can print two full helmets in like 38 hours, where a decent helmet on one of my CR10s usually runs me 75 to 80 hours, depending upon how we're printing. So, again, pros and cons to everything. It depends on where you want to invest your assets. Do you want to spend more time finishing things? Do you want to spend more money on material costs? There's also a lot more cleanup when it comes to the resin printing, because you need to do your post rinse, you need to do your post cure, you need to, God forbid, you get a leak in your vat, and then you need to clean all that up. Storage of chemicals,
right?
Which I know that was a big thing too, the whole chemical aspect of resin printing, especially as somebody who's strictly 3D prints. It turns a lot of people away from resin printing. But having like a sculpting and casting background, like I've got buckets of like two-part urethane resins and whatnot, and I've been working with that stuff for years. So it was just a matter of a different offshoot of kind of that aspect. But it's, again, like long story short, it depends on where you want to invest your assets, be it time or material costs or things like that. There are definitely benefits. Again, like you mentioned, like the resin prints just in general, even on the big guy, he's got a relatively lower pixel density or resolution, just because it's a 4K screen stretched out to a much wider surface area versus like
right.
a 4K screen on like the new Mars 3, which is a tiny little phone screen, or the regular Phenoms. But even that resolution and like the detail comes out pretty damn clean compared to any filament prints, unless you're calibrated to the point or running like an industry grade filament printer to where you're printing at 0.5 layer height, 0.1 layer height. But then you're also looking at 100 hours for a print.
Right. So it's right.
Trade-offs.
That's a great point. I think right now and at the time of this podcast, of course, like in a couple of months, someone could discover this and go, what are these guys talking about? But, you know, in I think the biggest thing is, you know, the CR10, I have a CR10 SV2 Pro or whatever I think it's called. And, you know, the big thing was a lot of people at the beginning was there was people who had to slice armor, right? They had to fit on their bed. And so when you had these like chess pieces or even helmets, people had to cut them up into like four quadrants and then fuse them together. And of course, we know that anybody who's ever put something together knows that, you know, a seam or any point where the material is broken can always be a weak point. And so then the filament printers got bigger and bigger, and the price didn't shoot up that much. I mean, I think I paid Black Friday special probably about $600, and I can print a helmet in one in on my bed size, which is great. And mm-hmm. I think the problem is most of the resin printers right now, if you want to get into something that's like big enough to wear, now you're in the couple $1,000 range,
right,
for something like that. So I'm looking for, I see on Kickstarter occasionally, you know, Elgu or someone has, hey, we've got this bigger print. I mean, they know that people want it. And I think they know, and that's, I think the future is always going to be, as more of these companies get competitive, that's where they start to drive the price down, which is great for all of us. And so I think probably within the next 2 or 3 years, I expect that resin printing will probably be the hobbyist standard, just because in terms of the common joke is like, you know, if you want to get into 3D printing, prepare to get, you know, tennis elbow and carpal right. tunnel and invest in, you know, 3M sandpaper. But, you know, so I think that you bring up great points. There's a lot of stuff that I didn't know about the real difference between, and as someone who works with both of them, it's cool to hear your perspective on it. Something that you had also said earlier, which I think is interesting, and with your background too, Tim, as a cosplayer and got into costuming with cosplay and all that, I've seen now that some of the requirements to get into some of these costume contests at some of these larger conventions, they're actually disallowing 3D prints. And you said that you were from a point of ignorance where you didn't understand it. And there was a part of me that I think, and I would love to just have a little ethical discussion on it, just because I'm curious your opinion on it. Because there is something to me that I had kind of talked myself in circles, because I went, okay, we all have 3D printers and we buy, you have people like Darren Patton who make incredible files. And then it's Josh from Chameleon Effects, right? I think that's,
yeah.
Yeah. So both of these modelers, and then you have people like Sean Fields who do incredible work, and they just give it away to people because he's awesome like that. But you have people who have these files that clearly are a step above. They have that same level of detail that they look for. They've done their work in terms of real life measuring, and the work has been put in. And you get these files and they're incredible. And then you get a really helpful tool like ArmorSmith that helps you fit it to your size body and all that kind of stuff, which I think is amazing and it's super cool. And I'm sure that it helps armor vendors feel like, yeah, what size do you need it at? Enter your spec. Okay, cool. Versus the, you know, the original Vacuform costumes where it's like, hey man, if you weren't 5'10 and probably about 170 pounds, you weren't going to be a stormtrooper. So in ways I love that we've embraced different body types and we have the abilities to be able to scale it. And then there is this ethical part of me that's kind of like the joke after COVID, of course, was that there were going to be a million Din Djarins walking around at conventions because he's such a great character and the armor is just so damn cool, right? And you would like go to the convention and I'm laughing, thinking like you look over and you're like, oh, hey, Great Apes Files. Yeah, Great Apes Files. Great Apes Files. Great Apes Files, right? Because the work is just so good. And so in some ways, it kind of took out some of the how-to and people finding those little details of, oh, hey, this didn't work for me. Oh, this didn't work. And I'm not building a great ape-based costume. And I found all kinds of goofiness on my own. And even today, like I needed to figure out how to attach, you know, these are like resin parts that fit into the flamethrower on the gauntlet. I cut a coat hanger and I drilled into one of the flamethrowers and then I stuck the other side into the gauntlet to make it stick out because the resin mm-hmm. was so thick in one section. And I'm kind of like, these are the fun little things that I remember. Like when you go to, you know, you troop with other people and you look at the inside of their armor and you're like, oh, that's how you rigged that up. Oh, wow. And like the forums were like sharing a lot of ideas. And 3D modeling is so precise that it's almost kind of taken a lot of that individuality out of it. But then at the same time, I'm going, ABS kits from one vendor all come off the same buck. They all come off the same, you know, we assemble them different oftentimes, but at the end of the day, they're not supposed to really be different. You're supposed to look like every other stormtrooper that stands next to you, no matter where you built it. So what are your, what's your take on that? Like, ethically, has 3D printing made it so that we are kind of just establishing a gold standard and no one really drops from that? Or like, what do you, you know, what's kind of your idea on it? Cause I know that you've worked with a lot of these great files and the work that they've done is worthy of every sale they've ever made because the files are incredible. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and I go back and forth between trying to figure out if this is just the new way of doing things from a lot of modern costumes moving forward, or are we still in this idea that like we build through individuality and our processes are all unique to our own story? I'm curious your thought on that.
I guess it really depends as a cosplayer or a costumer, kind of the goal that you're trying to achieve. We live in this wonderful world where like all body types, all skill sets, everybody, it's welcome, and it's such a welcoming community. Especially on the Star Wars side of the world, there is more of a level of accuracy that people are trying to achieve. So I have noticed that people who don't necessarily have the budget or the skill set to use some of these particular files or materials, they kind of get shunned. But it's all about, again, it's the community, and we're all the way I see it is we're all here to help each other. Be it no matter be it our end goal. It's if somebody wants to make armor out of foam, it's not necessarily the way that I would do it because it's not my end goal. I'm a stickler for details.
Sure.
I like the club specifications. But I also very much understand that that's not everybody's thing. And people just like working with foam. They want to work with materials they're comfortable with. They want to make a badass costume and they're happy with the work they're going into it. And they're happy with their end results, no matter what it is, because they enjoy the process, they enjoy doing it. And I feel that like I'm fortunate that I'm very well versed in many of these materials. So if I see somebody in the group like that, I have the knowledge to give them better suggestions for, like, say, an EVA foam base for this particular armor, versus like mod podging for sealer and like using Rust-Oleum or things like that. And I'll gladly put myself out there and help, but I'm trying not to get too off track, but like from an ethical standpoint with any costume in particular, I feel like as long as we're having fun and we're enjoying what we're doing and we're enjoying a part of the community, that's really all that matters. Like we're making fake stuff and dressing up. Like there's not supposed to be this serious stigma about putting on a cool costume and hanging out with a bunch of other nerds. Like we're all just a bunch of weirdos having fun.
Right.
It doesn't matter how we get to that point of being a visual weirdo. It's a matter of enjoying the process. So, very fortunate with like Darren and Josh putting out these amazing file sets, and like Galactic Armory and everybody too. And then people like Rob Pauza, who put all the free stuff out on Thingiverse.
Right.
All these people donating time, and then like Bill Duran of Punish Props and whatnot, putting out foam patterns for folk. And others, he's got a bunch of helmet foam patterns that people have been using. And I've seen a couple other people in like just some of the generic Star Wars groups doing like Pepakura or other foam things, just to give a very wide range of bases for people to start, because it is such a cool costume. It's such a cool take on this universe that we have grown up with and love. So I don't feel like there should be any exclusion with that. And visually, somebody that's working for a 501st build and somebody who's doing something EVA or like a basic skill set, it's there's going to be drastic visual differences to the end product, but there's no reason to discourage the person that's working with EVA foam, because we all start somewhere. Like, it's
exactly,
if you discourage that person from trying to make something that he wants to do and that, or they want to do and they have passion for, you could completely kill this hobby for them and just ruin the quality of their life. So I guess it's, hopefully I kind of stayed on track with,
no, that's fine. I think, cause you know, what I think I've been justifying to myself is I recognize more so in how crazy in this costume in particular. And I hope that if people are interested in just seeing really how complicated and cool the Din Djarin costume is, join the group for a couple of weeks just to see how truly incredible some of the makers are in this group. Because even just the fact that someone made with little servos actual whistling birds that come out of the frickin' gauntlets, I'm like, this is insane. And the fact that you can build a costume that in some ways might rival Legacies in so many ways, or as it's just a casual thing to wear to conventions, is so cool to me. And I think that's what makes, you see all this potential and you see that, then you get people like, you know, you look at Darren's Files of Great Ape as being the gold standard. Well, then all of these other makers are seeing how awesome the files are layered. So the, you know, the whistling birds on the gauntlet is separate so that you can put electronics in it. And then on the Mando pewter on the other gauntlet, it's like all of that is already removed. So you can just literally, you know, people have modeled accessories for the 3D files to be all work within those things. So in kind of ways you feel like, as someone who doesn't have those files, I'm like, man, I got to do a hell of a lot more work to hit that standard, because I love how much time has gone into doing something like the actual Mando computer on his gauntlet or the actual whistling bird. So it just, I think I, in some ways I had almost kind of like been envious. And then at the same time, I didn't know if anyone else was kind of having these feelings of feeling inadequate, because my build had potential to be something with actual whistling birds, but I don't think I'll be able to build it with these particular gauntlets that I have. So I'm just kind of like, I'm wondering if anyone else is having those same conversations. But you know, as someone who has intimate knowledge of both the process and has made all these files, I was just curious, because I love how dedicated those pieces are. And you can see it's true. Like I said, Darren at Great Apes, his files are worth every single penny because of the amount of work that he's done, not only to model something that is screen accurate, but also make it so that when you print it, it makes your life so easy, because it goes together like a freaking Lego. And versus like mine, which are just kind of raw resin. And it's like, man, the inside of my eye, I'll shave a ton of stuff. There was a ton of work that went into cutting my stuff out. And so I just look at how awesome and how clean and how great some of these 3D files are, because they're quite literally engineered. It's not like they're, you know, cast and you go, okay, I'm putting a bunch of resin in and I'm hoping this cast turns out good. It's like, no, man, this is like computer generated, machined engineering. These things are beautiful pretty much as soon as the printer finishes with them. So I love that. So I would also love to know, Tim, I have been such a fan of your paint jobs. And like I said, I constantly reference your dedication and your involvement in both the groups, but also your investment in yourself to go to remain a premier fabricator prop shop. For people who are listening that don't really understand what goes into the Beskar look. And at the beginning, we had like, oh man, it's bright chrome. And you're going, well, I can go to the, you know, Napa and I could buy the freaking chrome spray paint and just spray it chrome. And then as we saw more and learned more about it, and then would later find out that there's a specific paint that's used, that the paint is almost like a 70% dark chrome that truly can really only be applied by an airbrush. And then you have a sealer that goes on top of it, which the process now is doing a flat black primer. And this is for anyone who wants to get into airbrush or any kind of chroming. And I'm of course explaining it to the master as he sits right in front of me, but there's a, you know, there's a black primer, and then there is a settling agent, a glaze almost, that's called that's a 2K, which is two different chemicals. It hardens up, it creates this insane glossy finish. And then you apply the Alumiluster, which is the on-screen paint, which is a chrome paint at about 70%. And then you put more 2K on there, seal it in there. But the problem is, and I hope someone is in a, I hope someone is in an apartment in a city that's trying to figure out how the hell to do this, because that 2K stuff is incredibly toxic. It's nasty. And you are painting, like, you built an entire paint booth just to paint this stuff. So, like, tell me, what was your process in understanding both how that, how you guys figured out this was the process for getting that proper chrome? And then what you did to kind of say, if I want to commission these and be dedicated to building these, like, what was your, how did you rationalize going, man, I'm going to build a freaking paint studio inside my studio?
So it's, I've always enjoyed finishing work, and there is such an art and practice to a smooth gloss finish, because any imperfections in that base coat, it's gonna pop crazy throughout, like, being in the group and whatnot, and as we're all learning about these processes, kind of learning, like, how the film and movie industry, they achieve these in such a short amount of time, and that's where it comes up with that 2K gloss base. And then I honestly don't know how it was discovered that the Alumiluster was this green used paint, but so Sam's the owner of Imperial Surface, who makes Alumiluster, and he's a great guy. We'll answer any questions if you have any questions about paint techniques, spray guns, things like that.
Sure.
But, like, his work goes back to, like, the original Mark I Iron Man suit was done in his paint, the Alumiluster, and he kind of set the standard for industry grade movie metallic bases, and it's all based on this similar process with this catalyzed clear coat as a gloss base, and then your top coat, and being able to apply it and spray it properly. And so from there, if you don't work in a 100-year-old a warehouse in the Midwest, you can probably get away without building an enclosed booth, but there's so much damn dust that just drops from the ceiling that it was causing some major issues. So that's what led to that. But there's a lot of great spray equipment out there, especially specifically geared towards catalyzed clear coats. They're made to atomize the mist more appropriately, so you get a smoother coat, you get less worry about orange peel. For those not familiar with orange peel, it's when, instead of getting that nice mirror glaze finish, you kind of get like a rough speckly finish, and that's strictly due to the angle at which you're spraying, air pressure involved, the atomization of the gun, things like that. And while the better equipment does help with that, it also just takes a lot of practice. Trial and error, practicing the techniques, not fighting dust in a crazy dry Chicago winter, and just pretty much repetition is kind of how we got everything down. Not being afraid to ask questions. Buddy Jackson Rupert, who's on he's one of the active folk in the group. He also helped with the CRL. One of the best painters in the game.
Yeah.
Absolutely just humble and super nice dude. Shooting back and forth with him on techniques, and then talking about colors and things like that, playing out with different spray guns. We've both been bad influences on each other. Like, I was like, oh, I got a new gun today. And it's not the pew pew kind, it's the paint slinger kind. And then like we were joking around, like it was, we ended up for a little bit like doing a gun of the month club.
Oh boy.
Just playing with new spray equipment to better optimize the workflow and things like that.
Sure.
I guess a long story short, it's practice.
Sure.
Practice, experimenting, studying on the equipment, studying on the processes, studying on the chemicals. I guess we're fortunate to make this stuff look easier than it really is.
Yeah.
but there's so much failure that a lot of people don't realize, especially like when we're all posting stuff in these groups, and the people get frustrated with not being able to get that perfect finish and things like that. And it's we've been doing this for a little bit, and
right.
It shows, it helps that we also have the facilities and the gear and things like that.
Right.
I'm in a fortunate position to be able to invest in better equipment because it's my livelihood. Whereas a lot of hobbyists and people in the groups, again, they're hobbyists, so they don't, unfortunately, don't have that luxury. I guess developing the process and learning about the process to the base root of the question that you asked 47 minutes ago.
I'm listening yeah. for myself and being like, okay, all right, cool. Tim is telling me I'm going to be okay. All right. Sounds good, man.
You're good. It's just practice, trial and error, failure.
Sure.
One of the things, so we do a lot of like panels at conventions and things and like educational workshops and things, like especially in this field, in this hobby, it's much better to try that new skill and ask questions and completely mess it up, because that's how, as humans, that's how we learn. We learn through making mistakes. We learn through trial and error. We learn through doing the process, messing up the process, learning about how we messed up that process and what we need to do to resolve it for the future. And that's how we move forward with our skill sets.
So you're, and I think because Din is such a popular character and your feeling of, man, Din brought me back to life. And in many ways, I think it did, which is why so many people can, I think people always connect with hero costumes. And but then at the same time, there's something really cool about Din because he's a hero with a helmet, which traditionally we've only seen with bad guys. And so there was always kind of this thing where, you know, I look enough like Pedro Pascal, where like if I grew up my hair and gave myself a bloody nose, I could say that maybe I was, you know, him at the end of season one. But you know, for someone who's, you know, I'm not 6'1", slender build, so I don't think I'll ever be able to do a C-3PO. And then there's other characters where, like, you know, if you don't look like a character, there's some people who are too embarrassed to be like, well, man, I don't look like that guy, so I'm not gonna be Luke. And Din kind of had that approach to a lot of people where you could still be a good guy, but then get to the coolness and the, you know, the anonymous approach to wearing a helmet, which is kind of interesting. And I think in some ways that's part of why so many people were drawn to him as a character, not because he's an utter badass, but also because he's got cool looking armor, got an awesome story that's very intriguing to people. And so I think a lot of people, it was myself included, it was such an eye-opening experience for someone who's only built original trilogy characters and costumes where everything was based off of 1970s technology. So I never really, other than weathering, I never had to paint anything. Like anything that I had painted was minimal rattle can, you know, like, oh, hey, I'm going to spray paint my sand trooper backpack. Okay. Battleship gray. You spray it on there and then throw sand on it. You'd never know if I screwed it up or not. But Din is like, man, his whole story is part of that frickin' armor and how shiny it is. And I was building in a place I was building at the college here. And same thing. The one half of it is a woodworking studio. The other half is a fabrication and steel welding. And I would come in the morning after going, okay, nobody move. Nobody touch anything. The clear coat is settling. And I'd come in the morning and I'd be like, what the heck happened here? So much of that was making me pull my hair out. And then I was sitting here going, okay, well, you know, maybe we need to start wrapping some plastic up, or maybe we need to do something where, like, where I look at what Jason Derone does, where it's like, man, he's got a room that looks like a grow house in there, because it's just, it's sealed. Is there anything that you can recommend for people who are trying to get better finishes and better paint jobs? Because so many of the armors, the guns have roots in, especially I think as we're going to get more Mandalorian lore in there, and a Lumaluster is now becoming this, like, this gold standard of, like, oh, start with a Lumaluster. Are there things that you can recommend? Are there fans? Are there suction systems? Is it putting up plastic? Is it, you know, is there a way you can, you know, and like I said, that 2K stuff is nasty. Like, I recommend no one paint that inside ever for anything, unless you have some severe ventilation, or better yet, go outside and then probably still wear a mask because you don't want to breathe any of it in a back spray. So, like, what do you have as far as recommendations? Because I know that people listen to this podcast love the nitty gritty. What's some things that maybe hobbyists can do to get better finishes, Tim? Like, what could, you know, what are small steps in getting, you know, an approach to that?
Ventilation is definitely key, especially when spraying any of these paints. If you can do some kind of, like, enclosed tarp or something like that, it'll definitely help. In the Midwest, especially in the winter, also take in consideration the lack of humidity that's in the air. So you get all these dust particles floating around, and we get, like, 10% humidity. So there's no water vapor or anything to weigh those guys down. So I'll take one of my spray guns and just mist water in the area, which will kind of help grab on to any of those free-floating particles that you can't even see, and bring them down lower, get them out of the way, and let that settle. If you go on Amazon, they make, like, little pop-up paint tarps or paint, like, boxes, kind of like the collapsible college hampers.
Yeah.
But like 5x5 or something like that. And if you're in a pinch, you can get one of those for like $30, a 20x20 box fan, some angle brackets, and then a 20x20 filter. And then you can just drill those angle brackets into the frame of the box fan. So you got a little slot to slide your filter in, and then you can spray into that, put that behind that little pop-up paint booth, and that'll help a lot as well. As you get crazier and want to grow, there's like a bunch of different blower setups and things that you can get. Make sure you get something that's explosion proof, because especially with more of these lacquer based paints, or anything besides like acrylics and whatnot, you run the risk of causing a blowout with the fumes igniting in that blower as you're exhausting it. Tack cloth helps a lot. If you guys aren't familiar with tack cloth, it's an adhesive, a cheesecloth with like an adhesive on it. It's used in the painting industry, like the automotive industry. And the adhesive allows you to just like lightly tap on the surface to pull any kind of surface dust or residue, things like that. Also surface cleaners, waxers, degreasers, things like that are specifically made for like automotive paint prep, microfiber cloths. If you want to get really crazy, those $11 Tyvek suits, just because a lot of times I know my issue is if I don't put on one of those suits, I'll bring in like just random hairs and things like that. And as soon as I spray, they just flop off of my clothing because there's nothing covering it. So there's still, especially as a hobbyist, if you're spraying regular paints and even like the Alumiluster and like regular airbrush paints, you can kind of get away with painting that stuff in your apartment, like with that box fan setup. I used to do it. It's how I got the business started. Definitely not the catalyzed clear coat. You need like a true ventilation and spray setup or being outside for that. And like you mentioned earlier, still with like a full respirator as well. One thing to mention with those clear coats is the isocyanates, which is the bad stuff that lives in them. They are not technically filtered out by any of the 3M cartridges for the respirators. So if it's something that you are spraying consistently, it is very much recommended to have a full head coverage air-fed mask, because that's the stuff that'll give you the cancer pretty quick if you expose yourself regularly. And most hobbyists, they're not sitting there spraying at 6 hours a day, so limited exposure with a proper sealed respirator in the outside is pretty okay, but that's something to look into if you do decide to do this more. But it's make sure you've got some kind of decent ventilation, some kind of enclosed, at least top enclosed area that you can set stuff down. Thoroughly clean the area before you're spraying anything. After you are done cleaning the area, do like that nice mist with your gun or whatever, so you can let all the stuff that you stirred up while you were cleaning the area settle back down and keep that ventilation on so it also sucks it out. And make sure your surface is clean. Those are probably the best things, especially with this kind of finish, that I can recommend. It's once you get that base gloss coat down and you get that Aluma Luster on top, you're pretty much clear, which is great. It's that initial gloss coat over that the black sealer that's always the worst part of this dang build, because so many things that can go wrong.
Right.
So it's worth it taking an hour prior to that process to clean your gun, make sure the gun is dry, clean your area, vent the area, moisturize the area, just like over-prepare, and you should be good to go.
And then from there, the actual equipment that you're using, I just recently bought, I think at the beginning of this year, an Iowata Eclipse, which is, you know, great little detail brush. And I was lucky because, you know, it's got a smaller cup on it and I have to refill it quite often when I'm doing, you know, a big chest piece or something like that, or a helmet. I see people like yourself who are doing it properly. You know, if you want to upgrade from something like a hobbyist airbrush, which I think is what the Eclipse is, still like a, you know, a higher end, more, I don't know, I guess more of a dedicated. Yeah, it's a detail brush, but it's you've made the upgrade. It's not the it's not their standard like line that you would find at Michael's. It's definitely a professional grade, but it still has its limits. And then once you get into the ones that kind of look like it's a whole bigger version. But then you see people who are like, "Oh, I just went to Harbor Freight and bought something." I mean, for you, what's the difference of a good spray gun? And, you know, I think is it the HPC, the Iowata is the bigger gun, and that runs you, that's got a larger fan spray on it, nozzles. Like, can you share a little bit of light on what you would be looking at if you wanted to upgrade from a little tiny hobby air gun to, say, do more, you know, larger coverage stuff?
Yeah. So the larger Iowata series is the LPH-50 and the LPH-80, both fantastic guns. The LPH-50 is actually it's the gun that Imperial Surface recommends for the Aluma Luster. The biggest difference between the 50 and the 80 is the 80 has a traditional just like top-down gravity feed cup, whereas that's the 80, and then the 50 has a side mount cup. Both are great. I believe they both have interchangeable needles and nozzles. The 50 comes with the EV2, and various needle sizes. I think I've got the 0.6 in it. Just a finer spray, but still a wider spray than like the Iowata Eclipse, the HPCS. And then the 80 is made for a little more volume, so it's even got a wider spray over that with a larger needle, different cap and things like that. So pretty much it all depends on on what you're trying to achieve. Like you mentioned, the Eclipse is made for detail,
right.
Not a lot of the full coverage stuff. And it's got a cone spray pattern versus like the fan spray pattern.
Right.
Whereas any of your LVLP setups, like the LPH 80 and the 50, or your HVLP setups, like some of the larger coverage guns, they've got what's referred to as a fan cap. And instead of making that circle pattern, it's just a straight, like if you look at it from the side, it looks like an old school fan. But that gives you, depending upon your hardware setup and gun, it gives you anywhere from 2 to 6 inches of coverage per pass on that spray versus a dime size disc that you're working with on the Eclipse. So those are definitely better for base coats, for full coverage items, because you get a more even coat. Depending upon the paint that you're trying to spray to, you want to look at the different needle sizes and the cap sizes. Thinner paints, you want a smaller needle size so you get better optimization with the spray and the atomization. And thicker paints, you need a little more room to kind of get that level as well. So there's a lot of information out there, a lot of money you can spend.
Sure.
But yeah. The difference between spending that kind of money versus getting like one of the $20 to $50 Harbor Freight guns is there's a level of atomization and cleanliness to the spray that I think is better achieved through the better hardware, because that's what it's made to do. But also cleaning the damn thing. A lot of the cheap guns are real difficult to take apart. They're not as optimized inside, so you'll get more pitting in the metal, sharper angles, things like that. So you'll have a less optimized flow system. And they're essentially, especially like the $15 guns, they're made to be throwaways.
Right.
So, like to the point where the nozzle, if you go to take it apart, it's actually glued in there, and you need to crank it off with a wrench if you actually want to try to revitalize it after a couple uses. So it's,
yeah.
Better spray processes, better flows, and better maintenance abilities on the higher end guns, and because they're made to last, they're made to be used.
Right. And I think that big difference for people and when you're looking at it, because like for myself, right, like you're a commissioner. I know there's other people who are also commissioners. And you know, that, like I said, this is part of the investment of saying, if I want to make my life easier to do more of these for more people, then I'm investing in the equipment. It's like the whole idea of being like, you know, well, yeah, I have a bike, that's fine. But then if I'm going to start being, you know, a bike courier, you know, now I have to buy pouches for my bike. And I also want to make a comfier seat because I'm going to be on my bike more. And, you know, all of these, like just kind of these upgrades that you have to make over time. And for someone who's only going to, I won't probably make another, you know, a Lumaluster or some kind of, probably not another Chrome Beskar. And I'm saying that now because we have no idea what Book of Boba Fett is going to show us. But, you know, I can justify going, okay, I'm using my Eclipse and I'm getting, like you said, the little dime size where I have to go over when I'm painting a helmet. It's like, you know, it's very easy to all of a sudden realize I might've gone a little heavy on the Chrome because you're building up that Chrome over time versus, like you said, you get these big, you know, 6-inch, 8-inch fan passes where you're coating a lot more consistently versus building up areas, you know, one little dime size at a time. So those are the differences. And I think it's super helpful to hear you say that, because if I decide I want to go and get into something, it kind of lets me know that you're either going to save money up front or you're going to save yourself headache in the long run, you know? And I think that's really what it comes down to, a lot of these equipment pieces. So Legacy Effects, and we know talking with Drew and a couple other people that I've had on the show, that costume that we see on screen, whether it's Bo-Katan or whether it's Din Djarin, a lot of these new costumes for the stunt purpose of practicality are made out of silicone or rubber-like material. And they still are able to accept these really finicky paint jobs like a Lumiluster. The one thing that we haven't exactly figured out, because there are a couple people who have tested rubber silicone pieces, how to seal the Lumiluster so that they can weather on top of it, or do you think it's sealed at all? Are we close to cracking this mystery of how we've figured out how to get this shiny metallic silicone piece, yet it's not completely destroyed, or are they just literally respraying those costumes? What do you think that is?
So it depends on what it is. I believe a lot of the Din stuff is it's a harder urethane rubber. So the 2K cooler coats and the Lumiluster itself, they do have a certain degree of flex to them. So as long as it's more of a rigid rubber, which they do use a lot in the show, there is a certain amount of flex, but there's also, for like the more bendy stuff, another Imperial Surface product called Imperiflex in cashmere. It's a high gloss and a matte, very, very flexible catalyzed clear coat. It's actually a three-part system that they use, but a lot of the super suits use this not only as the gloss base, but the top coat, just because it's super, super bendy. I've got very soft polyurethane, like foam props and stuff for like stunt weapons that I've made, and just doing some tests on it. And the level of flexibility on your top coat is solely based on what you're put underneath it.
Sure.
So where a lot of people make mistakes is they'll do like the rattle can gloss bases and whatnot, and those are very, very rigid paints when they set up, so any kind of movement and they crack, whereas the Imperiflex and the cashmere they're made for those bendy uniform, like a bendy urethane metallic coats. So that's a lot of the stuff that they're using, but it's pricey industry grade material, so that's why it's not really well known, kind of like how the Lumiluster wasn't really well known in the hobby side of the world until it's like, oh, we know what paint was used on the screen. It's $400 a quart.
The cost of perfection.
Yeah. and depending upon the urethane rubber that's used too, you can often, for like some of these less gloss finishes, you can paint right on top of it. So it depends a lot on the base material, the overall finish. But a lot of the high shiny gloss stuff, one of the best ways to achieve that is using the Imperiflex for your gloss base and your top coat. It's just, you're adding probably another $400 worth of materials to your build.
Holy cow. So well, Tim, this conversation has been fantastic, because not only have you told us all about airbrushes, you've also told us how not to blow up our blowers and our ventilation systems, how not to get cancer, and now what you think is the way of making flexible armor in case you want to absolutely ball out and make yourself an on-screen representation of Din Djarin. So, Tim, thank you so much for sitting down with me and talking.
Thank you, Mike.
It's been such a treat to pick your brain and tap in your expertise. I love exactly that we have people like you and the rest of the group as being leaders for opening some of those doors, pulling back some of the curtains, and like you said, just being nerds together and enjoying this hobby that I think has inspired so many people and continues to inspire people. I think we're normalizing this process of being an adult with adult money and realizing that it's okay if what you're doing isn't hurting anybody and it's showing off your passion, man, lean into it. Like, I feel like the amount of people that I know that know me as the Star Wars guy in my group, but kind of get inspired to say, man, if that's just what you're into, then go for it. And I think it's been encouraging that we've seen people now, you know, Halloween is more fun for people. And, you know, like you have people who are like, hey, I want to dress up and do this. Like, what do you think? And then you kind of just start to see those gears turn for like, being an adult is boring. That's literally the tagline of this show is being an adult is boring. And that all of this stuff that we're doing is way fun. And I feel when I talk to other people who have made a career out of it, like yourself, it gives me a lot of hope to say this hobby is in such good hands. So Tim, thanks for being a part of the conversation. But before we go, we've got to do a lightning round where I've got to ask you some questions.
Oh, heck
is
yeah.
That all right? We got to do that. We got to do that. All right.
Of course.
Boba Fett was recently brought back from the Sarlacc pit with a restored, or Boba Fresh, depending on who you ask, look. Which character would you bring back from the dead with the same intention of redesign?
Oh, man. Oh, that's such a tough question. I was originally going to say Fennec, but she's already back.
Spoiler alert. Yeah, who's listening to this podcast that isn't completely up to date to Star Wars? Let's be real.
I don't remember her name. The female that was a part of the team in the Solo movie that got killed on the
Val.
Train. Val, yeah.
Yeah.
She was awesome.
Was.
She had a cool played costume, by cool character. Yeah.
Thaddea Newton, I believe. Yeah. She had an awesome look. She had the almost like German inspired steel handle grenades. Like there was something really sweet about that. And what would you do? Like just knowing that she kind of had that trench coat vibe, she had minimal armor. You know, what do you think when you look at a character like that, like what kind of spins in your head? Does she get a new look? Does she get, you know, what for as a costumer yourself?
She always kind of gave me kind of that like Star Wars techie, like engineer-y, just like heist attitude. So maybe like some kind of cyborg aspects with like gadgets to help her with her heists and things like that.
Yeah.
Just kind of build on that original look with some additional like classic Star Wars cybernetics and Greeblies and things like that.
Yeah.
Maybe some additional weapons.
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. That's a great answer. I was not expecting that, Tim. I was going to say maybe the ones I think that everyone comes to mind is like, oh man, let's do new Mace Windu or something. But Val, man, that's a great one. That's a great one. I love that. If you had access to the Lucasfilm archives and you could closely examine any costume, which costume would you choose?
Oh man, these are tough questions.
It's not, I know, lightning round has changed from originally like, you know, what do you like more? Like, you know, a green or a blue lightsaber? But now I'm like, I have great guests on. And so I have to ask good questions that people would be like, dang, that is a good question. What's he going to answer?
I'm torn between one of the Han Solo costumes or like ESB Fett. The five original bounty hunters would be awesome to see.
Besides Fett, do you have a particular one that you'd be like, I gotta check that out?
Maybe Forlom.
Yeah, that's a good answer.
Bug-eyed bastard.
Right, and then you're almost worried if you would be disappointed because, like, you know, IG-88 was like literally screwed into the floor because.
Right, he's so janky.
Right, and then you have like Zuckuss, who basically was just a tiny person that they put in and like covered up with like a military tarp, and they're like, that's your overcoat now.
Right, you know? and then Bossk just wearing the old Doctor Who spacesuit.
Right, exactly, with like these like kind of hilariously grotesque extra appendages that you don't know if could actually be squeezed or not. That's an awesome answer. So I love that answer because I think people tend to go to the costumes that like they love. So of course I can empathize with Han, but yeah, that's the bounty hunters, to see them again would be really cool. If you could bring one prop home from the Lucasfilm archives, Tim, what would you bring?
The studio scale Falcon.
How big is your house, Tim? Would big it be enough. Big enough to house that enough that someone that would you'd have to have your own room? That's the Falcon room, and people would be like, "What do you mean?" You walk in there. Yeah. Oh, this is just a room for the studio. Well,
not like the full scale, like the recording model.
Okay, but that's still what 4 feet long,
4 or 5 feet. Yeah. I guess if the Crest was there, I would. The Crest has become my new favorite Star Wars ship. So I don't know if it lives at Legacy or if it's at LucasArts or where. If that was there, I'll take the Crest. May she rest in peace. But
there's one there and there's one in Favreau's house.
Oh,
it's probably easier to get it from Lucasfilm Archives at this point.
Maybe, yeah.
Tim, are you a blaster or a lightsaber kind of guy?
I'm a blaster guy.
And which blaster are you? If you could have one blaster from Star Wars at your side, which would it be?
The A New Hope DL-44. Just strictly, whenever I play games and whatnot, I'm a glass cannon kind of style caster.
Sure.
Or like engineer. And the DL-44 was outlawed because it was too powerful a gun. So that's, If I want something on my side, I want something that's going to pack more punch than it's supposed to.
Sure. Famously called
sweet little package.
The Greedo Killer, I believe.
Yeah.
In the stunt world, that's what it's called. So that's a great choice. I would say most people would probably side with you on that. You get to work on any of the upcoming series over the next 3 years of Star Wars. Which project do you choose?
I would say Mando.
Mando season 3.
Yeah, Mando, hands down. We're going to have more Bo-Katan, we're going to have more Fett, we're going to have more everything, and there's just going to be possibly more Luke Skywalker.
Sure.
That would be a dream gig.
So, I think you already answered it, but I just need to confirm. To fly to this project, you need to, of course, have a ship. Which ship from Star Wars would you choose?
Gonna use my Crest.
That's fine because that's a badass ship.
Hunky junky, badass, functional, beautiful beast.
Well, you heard it from him. He's a fan of DL-44s. He's a fan of properly ventilating his paint jobs, and clearly, still missing the Razor Crest. Tim Harrison, thank you so much for joining us on Armor Party. Tim, where can people find you and follow along with your incredible work?
Thank you again for having us. It's been an absolute pleasure. If you guys have any questions about anything, we are HDC Fabrication on all social media. It's Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Vero, if people are still using that. And then www.hdcfabrication.com. Again, like any questions about fabricating, be it Star Wars or anything, like we're well-versed in many, many, many materials, please do not hesitate to ask.
I love that. And you're pretty centrally located in the Midwest. Over the next, between now and Celebration, are there any conventions you plan on going to?
We'll be at C2E2 in Chicago in December. I believe it's the weekend of the 12th this year. We'll have a big booth presence and presentation presence there as well.
Awesome.
And also providing the convention with any costume repairs. And then we'll be at Holiday Matsuri in Orlando, Florida the following weekend doing similar presentations and whatnot.
And then hopefully we'll see you at Celebration.
Yes, as long as I got a hotel booked. As long as I can get a ticket for the dang convention, I will be there in one way or another.
Awesome. Well, Tim, thanks again for joining us on Armor Party. I look forward to sharing your story and all of your work among our social media. So if there's any other last words you've got, Tim, hit us with it.
Always keep creating. Don't be afraid to fail and just try. Do it. Have fun. Enjoy it.
And of course, may the Force be with you. Wasn't that one heck of an episode with Tim Harrison of HDC Fabrication? Please do tag Tim, follow him, let him know that you appreciate that he is an absolute treasure trove of information in all things making and costuming. You know, even as a host, I love learning about the process, the behind the scenes, if it's tools or whatever. anything that I can do to listen and share the stories of professionals at Tim's level, I feel like benefits us all. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation. Once again, I am your host, Mike Forrester. Armor Party is a part of the Thank the Maker Network. Our sister podcast consists of bands of Yellow Card, Story of the Year, and Bayside, and they share their collective love of Star Wars, current breakdowns, and the state of Star Wars as we know it. Give them a listen wherever you get your podcasts and follow along with the upcoming Visions breakdown. And I helped be a part of this really cool What If series we did through Star Wars. So give them a follow. Thank the Maker Pod on Instagram. Our incredible theme is written and composed by my talented friend from grade school, Alton James. He's down to work with you on your next Star Wars fan film or project. Check out his insane portfolio of work at Alton_James on Instagram. We will see you in 2 weeks. And always remember, my friends, being an adult is boring, but building Star Wars armor is anything but.
Proceeding as I have foreseen.